Hello everybody and welcome back. I hope you had a good break and got yourself a cold drink or maybe a hot drink. You know, we academics are pre-programmed to talk for 2 times 45 minutes with a 15-minute break between the two sessions. And for this and many other reasons, I find this a challenge to lecture in this way. But it's quite fun nonetheless. The learning curve is steep, and I think we're getting there eventually. So without any further ado, let's move on to the second condensed, compressed version, overheated perhaps, part of this lecture on cities and urbanization. So in the previous session, I spoke in fairly general terms about the growth of cities in relation to changes in the economy, higher productivity in agriculture, pressure on the land, forcing people away from the land in various ways, and some of the characteristics of cities. I also emphasized the unevenness of growth within a city. Certain things grow faster than others. Population tends to change much faster and grow much faster than infrastructure. And I spoke about infrastructure. I didn't even mention services. You know, the services you need, the postal service, the bin man, you know, who comes and empties your rubbish, hospitals, schools, all of these facilities, which are unavailable to many of the people who live in the poorer parts of cities in the global south. There's a rather grim and pessimistic, but pretty good, actually, book by the geographer Davis called Planet of Slums from 2007. So it's not brand new, but it's not dated. I mean, the figures may be dated, but not the arguments. And he depicts a situation where he says that, you know, in West Africa, for example, there's a stretch of land ranging from, going from Benin City in Nigeria all the way to the outskirts of Accra in Ghana, which is now increasingly a continuously built up area. In other words, a continuous sort of urban area, slums, informal settlements, whatever you choose to call them. And in many cases, these informal settlements are not really suburbs of any city. It's not as if they can take a bus to a city centre. They're just informal settlements. And the people who live there may be the anthropologist Tanya Lee, in another context, has spoken of as superfluous populations, populations which are in the way, which contribute little to GDP, who are poor consumers because they don't have a lot of money, and who are basically just in the way. There have been situations in some cities in the global south, ahead of big summit meetings when they get luminaries from around the world, or big sporting events, you know, when journalists come in and want to take photos and write their stories, where they have simply raised slums. They've simply destroyed them. They've given people maybe a warning a day or two ahead so that they could, you know, fetch a few belongings and move away. And in they come, and they just raise and remove the slums so that the city should look nicer to the visitors. So there is inequality, there is unevenness. I spoke quite a bit about this today. In this session, I'm going to go into a couple of other things. But first, something general. David Harvey's article, not really about cities, but it's about the logic of capitalism. Keep in mind that David Harvey, very highly respected, very influential human geographer, but as you would see from his article, also a Marxist. So he uses the sort of framework of Marxism in order to understand global capitalism and global change. The article is not brand new, 15 years old, which in the past didn't come across as particularly long, but owing to the fast changes taking place in the world today, it is a bit old. But the theoretical framework, which to some extent is even older, can probably be used today as well. So he introduces the very useful term accumulation by dispossession. Now, the logic of capitalism entails growth. So there is this energy, this creativity, this power in capitalism that drives people who are participants in this particular economic system, and especially the leadership segment in this particular economic system, to search for new opportunities to increase their profit because of the generally falling profit rate. A concept that was introduced already by Karl Marx, that unless you change, your profit will slowly begin to decrease. So you have to look for new markets. I would like to add something to this, to the idea of the falling profit rate. Namely, the fact that in a competitive situation, you always have to improve. Because the neighbor does, the other guy does, the other people does. Think about football teams. It doesn't help that Düsseldorf is much better this year than last year, if Bayern Munich is even better. So you have to improve more than the others. You have to move continuously and develop and evolve in order to just keep your place in a hierarchy. This is an insight from evolutionary theory, which can be applied, not uncritically, but it can contribute to shedding light on competition and on the logic of capitalism, where we compete with each other. So we have to improve more than the others, and we have to look over the fence all the time to see what they're doing. That is also part of the story of expansion. So the growth imperative, I mean, there are basically a couple of ways in which you can alleviate and control and counteract the falling rate of profit. One is by expanding your markets, move into new markets, get new people to buy your stuff, or employ new people to produce whatever it is that you're doing. Or you can intensify consumption where you are, make people consume faster. For example, I mean, one metaphor, I guess, mainly for this is the new facility that you get on Netflix where you can watch your films at double speed. You know, that makes you an efficient consumer, doesn't it? Twice as efficient as before. It's almost like a joke, but it's consistent with the general logic of intensifying consumption. Make sure that people chuck out their clothes and buy new stuff more quickly than they did a few years ago, and you will continue to grow, and your end of year accounts will look good. Or you can expand into new markets. And this is really accumulation by dispossession. You take away something that people used to have, such as land or their own labor or their natural resources. You find ways of controlling those. For a while, it was fairly easy to do it. You did it through conquest, through military conquest and colonialism or investment. Today, it may be a bit more difficult, but it is still taking place, and it's not just a matter of sort of evil people exploiting poor people. It's a logic of the economic system, and for people who have faith in that system, it generates a better life for everyone. You know, it's better to be exploited by United Fruit than not to be exploited at all, they would say, because if you're not being exploited at all, you just sit around and starve. With United Fruit, at least you have a job. My previous PhD student, Robert Pipers, you're reading an article by him in this course on mining in Sierra Leone. He says that, you know, many of the peasants in Sierra Leone that he knew, they were quite flexible in the sense that peasant life is flexible because you have a couple of pigs, maybe you have some chickens, you grow a bit of maize, you have a few oil palms. So if one of the crops fails, you still have something that you can do and that you can rely on. But it says that this life is very hard and it's unpredictable, even though it's flexible. So many of them would prefer to get a poorly paid job in a mine for a foreign company rather than being flexible and free peasant. So keep this in mind as well. It's not simple. The story is never straightforward. So over-accumulation in harvest terminology and that of others refers to resources that you need to invest. Remember, a couple of weeks ago, I spoke about the idea that bullion, or you know, gold and silver, were the source of wealth that was held by Spanish and Portuguese, and which led to the decline of those empires from the late 16th century onwards, because they needed to reinvest. So if you have a lot of money or resources of some kind, you have to invest them, and you have to find ways of doing it in order to prevent the falling profit rate from affecting your business, and in order, you know, to basically to keep going in competition with others. So you expand, and you do this in various ways. So Harvey also has something to say about the financial system, about which I spoke a bit a couple of weeks ago, and you're reading Bill Morris' excellent article on the financial, on the world financial system. And Harvey shows, from his perspective, where he's concerned with inequality and with exploitation, and with the, you know, the structural underpinnings of a particular kind of world order, where some become richer and others remain poor. That the financial system, in fact, relies on uneven geographical development, because you have financial capital, whether it's your own or you borrowed it from some bank or whatever, and you need to place it somewhere, and you need to find a place to invest it where there is a vacant niche, you know, where there is potential, right, where not much is happening. So you see what I mean? Uneven development globally is necessary for the financial system to function and to thrive. And one side of the coin is investments, another side of the coin is credit. And we have a saying in Norwegian saying that being poor is expensive. Det er dyrt å være fattig, which means that if you don't have anything and your heater goes bust, in your house, and it's crucial, you know, in this climate, to have a functioning heater, and you don't have the money, you have to take a really expensive loan, because you may not be creditworthy with the bank, because you don't have anything, you had debt, you don't have money, so you have to take a really expensive loan from someone, upwards to, I mean, 30% actual interest, that sort of thing, in order to pay it back, and in the end, you may never be able to pay it back. This is part of the debt trap in which many of the countries in the global south find themselves, that they have incurred debts which are technically unrepayable owing to the growth in interest and compound interest. Of course, countries in Africa spend far more money on simply paying their debts every year than they receive in foreign development assistance. So these are two sides of the financial system, credit and investments that keep the system going. Now, Harvey has a really nice formulation where he somehow lists many of the factors that you could say are expressed through this convoluted general umbrella term of accumulation by dispossession. You accumulate by dispossessing others. And I'm going to read it out. It's in the middle of the article, and it looks like this. Okay, so we talk about, I'm just going to read it out and maybe unpack it as I go along. The commodification and privatization of land and the forceful expulsion of peasant population. This means that you get, as I said, you get a paper, a document, from a government which states that you own this land, and the peasant population who used to live there don't have that paper, so they can fairly easily be thrown out or invited to work as wage workers on your new project, on your plantation. So conversion of various forms of property rights, common, collective, state, etc., into exclusive private property rights. Property of land is an alien concept, as I've already said, in most non-capitalist societies. So it had to be converted into something that you own. You can put a fence around it and you can say, this is mine, and you don't have the right. You're trespassing if you enter. Suppression of rights to the commons. Now, the commons is an interesting concept here, because the commons, as we would say in Norwegian, allmenningen, allgemeine, and it comes from that, the German terms, that which is common, is that which is commonly not owned, but for which there is common, you might say, responsibility for the stewardship and the management of something. So you don't really own it. Nobody can own it, but you have responsibility living in the place and making use of the resources for taking, you know, looking after it and taking care of it. Commodification of labour power and the suppression of alternative indigenous forms of production and consumption. You may have noticed in Eric Wolff's chapter that you read a few weeks ago that he speaks of the tributary mode of production. Tribute, paying tribute, is not alien to Europeans. I mean, people had to pay tribute to the church, for example. 10% of your produce, or you had to pay tribute to a feudal landlord or to a chief. In many small-scale societies, this chief was also in charge of redistributing whatever he got by form of tribute from his subjects, redistributed to those in need. In fact, there were chiefs in Africa that used to, I'm sorry, I'm saying Africa, I know Africa is a big place, okay? There were chiefs in Central Africa that complained to anthropologists that we are the poorest in our village. We are the poorest people in our village because we have to give gifts all the time and we have to make sure that nobody's starving. So these were, excuse me, alternative, non-market forms of production and consumption, which are being replaced by the monetization, commodification of labour and of land. Colonial, neo-colonial and imperial processes of appropriation of assets, including natural resources. Yeah, I mean, you know what that means. That suddenly someone owns the forest where you used to hunt and gather stuff and maybe grow your bananas. Monetization of exchange and taxation, particularly of land. So even if you're lucky to be able to stay on your land as a peasant, suddenly one morning you discover that the state requires of you to pay tax, which you never had to do before. Slave trade, which we know, and usury, the national debt and ultimately the credit system. So this is not merely about privatization. It can also be run by states, right? It's not an either-or thing that either you have, you know, you have private capital or you have a state. States carry out much of this work as well, not least through infrastructural development, where you build a highway. And what about the people who used to live there? You know, they were fishermen. Well, they'll have to find something else to do. So they will migrate probably into the nearest city and see if they can get a living there. Or you've decided as a mayor of a city that we really want a modern, nice shopping mall, okay, air-conditioned with a big car park outside. Now there are some people who live there and they grow some crops, but they will have to go. You may give them a bit by way of compensation, but not enough for them to start a new life. So you see what I mean. And this is why this is an overheating phenomenon. Because it's about a world in which there is a crunch. There isn't enough space. There's a scramble for resources and they are becoming increasingly scarce. Some resources are becoming increasingly scarce. I mean, in Mauritius, where I have much of my work, which is currently going through a horrible environmental tragedy because a Japanese cargo ship, excuse me, an oil tanker, Japanese oil tanker, ran aground on the reef. Started to leak out oil. And there you see the clash of scales that I've been talking about, which is a part and parcel of contemporary globalization. The Japanese ship owner takes no responsibility for it. They're saying that, you know, they're blaming bad weather and so on. They may have to pay some compensation eventually, but they did nothing. The Mauritian government waited for 12 days before taking action, and the action they took was inefficient. So people in Mauritius became very cross with and very angry with the government. This is a country where being angry with the government is allowed. Okay, you can say nasty things to your government without being thrown into jail, and yet power is concentrated in a few hands. So what did people do who lived in that particular area in southeastern Mauritius? Who were fishermen? Some of them were involved in the tourist business, which of course, I mean, it was gone anyway, owing to COVID-19. But it's going to take probably 10 years until that stretch of beach recovers. And it will never recover entirely because so many animals, so much marine life is gone. What did they do? Well, they went down there with buckets and tried to, scoop up as much oil as they could and fill it into larger containers on a very small scale. Some of them went out into the fields and cut tall grass, you know, and even sugarcane in order to try to produce bulwarks that might absorb some of the oil and prevent it from reaching the beach itself and utterly damaging the beach, you know, by leaving this sort of sticky, stinky, black stuff. So there you see the clash of scales. Japanese owners far away. Oh, something happened in Mauritius. Maybe we should look into it. Yeah, maybe next week. Mauritian government. We're so busy dealing with COVID-19 that we don't really have the time for this, but let's see what we can do next week. Locals, we have to act immediately because this is our environment. You see, the small scale kicks in, and in fairly inefficient ways, but at least, they did what they could. So why am I saying this? Yes, because I'm now moving on to talking about, this is because they considered it a commons. This is ours, you know, it's collective. Everybody has to chip in and do something. There are even volunteers from other parts of Mauritius who have come down and I've been trying to help. So back to appropriation by dislocation or by dispossession. Could be dislocation also. Land grabbing. Where do we see land grabbing most blatantly in the contemporary world? Mining, surely. Mining operations these days are not what they used to be. I mean, coal mining is not what it used to be. Coal mining used to be the digging of underground tunnels where scores or hundreds of miners walked down, you know, and they had a kind of railway that went down, okay, into the shafts. And they filled up the carts and pushed them up, sometimes by muscle power, sometimes with some kind of engine. This is no longer the typical form of coal mine. In certain countries, like India, underground mines are still widespread. But in most of the coal mining world, coal mining is now open pit, which means that instead of making all these tunnels, you just take some very large machines, like excavators, and you rip off, you know, the vegetation, the soil, and all the everything that covers the coal in order to get at the coal or the other mineral resources. This, from an environmental perspective, is far more destructive than the old form of coal mining, where in fact most of the landscape was left intact. So people are driven off the land directly or indirectly through mining operations, and not just. People in the so-called third world or in the global south. I've seen this happen in Australia as well. Not forcefully, they're not at gunpoint being, you know, threatened, but people who have moved to a rural place in order to grow crops, grapes, or to raise cattle or sheep, and to gaze at the stars in the evening, and to relish the fresh air, and so on. Wake up one morning to noise and dust and lights that never go out. So they haven't only lost, as it were, the serenity of the scenery. They've lost the peace and quiet, the clean air, and even the starry sky, because the floodlights are on at night as well. So by all means, mining, plantations. Obviously, and it's plantations illustrate another point that I made earlier about overheating, about homogenization, standardization. the way in which that which is regimented, efficient, and simplified gets the pride of place. Because plantations, I mean, the main culprit mentioned in much of the literature today are oil palm plantations, but one can think of many other kinds of plantations. Cotton, for example, which have cotton plantations which have contributed to virtually emptying what, when I was a boy, was one of the world's largest lakes, the Aral Lake in what was then the Soviet Union. Right? But so we could think of other crops as well. But the point about plantation is that it's monocultural, it's standardized, and it requires quite a bit of labor input, but it's a kind of labor input which is very, very restricted. Everybody has a job, just like in a McDonald's restaurant. Everybody has a job. It's monotonous, and it's time-consuming, and it's laborious for the people involved. Quite unlike what they did before. And yet, some people may prefer to work in a plantation rather than being independent peasants. But from an ecological point of view, it's very destructive, and also regarding who has the question of who has the right to claim stewardship or ownership to land. Plantations are encroaching on people's land. Urban development, paradoxically, urban development and other forms of infrastructure development, as I've already mentioned, may in fact contribute to urbanization as well. I mean, people who are pushed off the land because of mining, people are pushed off the land because of plantations. Many of them move into cities to make a living there. And people who are pushed off their land because of urban development, because of the growth of cities and the growth of urban infrastructure, such as highways, also move into cities. I could have mentioned other examples as well, but these were the first I could think of. Now, finally, a few words about Elizabeth Schauber's important research in Subic Bay in the Philippines. Now, this is where Subic Bay is. Now, the Philippines is an interesting country. The Tagalog-speaking Filipino culture somehow doesn't fit into our standard ideas about what the world looks like. It's East Asian, but it's not East Asian in the way that China or Taiwan is East Asian. It's sort of Southeast Asian, but it's not like Indonesia or Thailand either. So the Philippines, obviously the Philippines contains a lot of different ethnic groups, some of them indigenous groups. But the dominant Filipino culture is what you could call Latin Asian. It was colonized by the Spanish, later by the Americans. So on the whole, people don't speak a lot of Spanish, but there are many Spanish place names. And the Spanish influence lingers in the cuisine and in certain other parts of Filipino life. For example, in the Catholic religion that most Filipinas share. So it's interesting in this respect. Now, Subic Bay, as you see, not very far from Manila, but you know, it's a fair drive. It was the site of an American naval base, as Elizabeth Schauber describes in her article, and is now, or rather it was, at the time when she wrote, the site of a Korean-owned outsourced shipyard, which also, again, reminds us that North and South are relative concepts. The South Korean company Hanjin, clearly a company of the global North, was a very powerful actor in the world of shipping and transportation and shipbuilding until it went bankrupt. But they'll be coming back in one way or another. It was outsourced because of the unruliness of the labor movement in Korea. And the sort of increased demands from workers and so on. So at a certain point, the Hanjin executives understood that they would get far more value for their money if they moved to the Philippines. So they set up in this abandoned bay, abandoned by the Americans some years earlier. The naval base was closed down in 1992, which gave work to a lot of people, and which led to the emergence of probably one of the largest red light districts in the world. So the Americans went, and in came the Koreans and built this shipyard, offering work for men mainly, whereas many of the people who had served the Americans had been women, working in bars and brothels and so on. So Elizabeth Schauber describes in an interesting way the sort of the volatility and the unpredictability and the very strangeness of this kind of urban development that comes from outside. At first, something came from outside. It was the American naval base. And people just had to relate to that somehow or other and try to make a living with the Americans. And the Americans were quite popular because they provided work and money and so on in an otherwise impoverished area. And now the Koreans have come. They have they offer different kinds of work. It's industrial work and it's mainly male work. And it's, you know, it's not well paid, and it is also in a country where organizing yourself in trade unions is mainly illegal. So there are very few opportunities for the locals to voice their concerns vis-a-vis the management. So they are, and they are precarious. I mean, they can be laid off at any time, and they were laid off en masse without any consequences for the owners of the shipyard. So it's easy. A fairly easy place to be in this way. So they were precarious, and Elizabeth Schauber also writes interestingly about the relationship between precarity and informality, because lots of people have small income through the informal sector. But that is not the main point. The main point about the article is really that many people miss the Americans. They're nostalgic about the time, you know, when you had the Americans with dollars, you had a red light district, you had a bustling nightlife. It was like a place of pleasure and enjoyment, at least for the Americans. The people who mainly miss the Americans seem to be Filipino men, because now it's them who are exploited. I'm not sure about the women. I have to ask Elizabeth Schauber when I see her, when she's back at work. She's now on maternity leave. As you would know, she works at our department. I'm going to also read out and maybe unpack at the end the final paragraph in her article, which, just like the quotation from David Harvey, it somehow condenses many of the points. She says that while Korean investors have been particularly apt at strategically utilizing their old and wide-ranging connections with the US military and its installations in the Philippines, their interventions in Djibouti have certainly not been greeted with, I think, universal approval. So they're not that popular. And paradoxically, she says, it's local memories of the good old days when the US Navy was still around in Subic Bay that have served as a form of resistance to the kind of unhampered super exploitation of the Filipino workforce that these East Asian investors have brought to the area. So things have gone somehow from one situation to one situation which is perceived as being worse. The economic overheating, work-related accelerations, and political discontinuities that have come to act on Subic, etc., are countered with a longing for old stability that sits rather uncomfortably with some of the realities of that particular past, because things were not so rosy. And what does this tell us something about? I think it tells us about something which is not mainly about cities, although Olongapo City is an interesting place to study in terms of fast change, because it really went up and it overheated and then it cooled down and it stayed cool for a long time and then it started heating up again. Someone should go there now when the shipyard has closed down. It may reopen, but it hasn't at the time of this lecture opened yet. But I think it says something about cities, it says about life. But I think it also says something about memory, about social memory. She quotes somewhere in her article the anthropologists Angers and Berlinet, who have written about nostalgia. And isn't it the case that in an overheated world, there's a big market for nostalgia? Things happening really fast. Nobody asked me for my opinion. Things used to be so much better. This is the kind of attitude we tend to associate with old geezers like me, okay? The older you get, the more nostalgic you get for the past. But which is now becoming more general, and it's sort of creeping down into younger cohorts who are longing for a past when things were less chaotic and less erratic and unpredictable. On that note, I think I should end. And again, feel free, as always, to contact me on Canvas, and we can continue the discussion then. So I'll be seeing you all again next week. Cheers.